All right, welcome to the Adventurers Club of Los Angeles. We're here this Thursday evening with Mark Weitz, member 1145. 44. 1144. Yes. Thank you for the correction. Again, welcome. It's Thursday night. We're here every week. Thank you for coming down.
Thank you for having me, and I really appreciate you guys keeping this going during the lockdown. Having these things every Thursday night, it's really been a great thing to watch from home.
We got to do something, right? The whole idea is that we are telling stories of adventure, right? And we're letting people come in and basically, you know, fulfill the mission of the club,
yeah.
Right? So for our viewers out there, a reminder, this is live, and we do accept questions. So jump in that comment section, leave your questions for Mark, and at the end we'll do a Q&A. So keep those questions coming as you got them. So Mark, you are a traveler. You're an adventurer. You're actually a president of the club, right, back in 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And you served on the board of directors.
Yeah, I was on the board of directors for 4 years. Still have nightmares from that. it was very fulfilling, too. I did a lot for the club. When I first joined, I wrote for the newsletter and got as involved as much as I could. Really enjoyed the kind of people I met here and hearing about their adventures, and was able to give back by being on the board and being president, and it's been a great club and led to a lot of good friendships and adventures.
Very cool. Well, we definitely appreciate your work mm-hmm. on the board and as president. So we're here to talk about your adventures. You've done a lot of stuff, right? You've traveled to over 114 countries, right?
Mm-hmm. It's something like that. I think it's 117 or 118. I need to count again.
You're a pilot. Mm-hmm. You're a private pilot, scuba diver, but mainly an adventure traveler, right? So tonight we're here to talk about your summer vacation. And you decided to go to Northern Iraq and Pakistan for your summer vacation, right?
That's right, yeah.
So how'd you pick that? You know, like lots of people are sitting on the beach of Belize or, you know, in a tropical location, but you picked probably one of the most adventurous travel destinations that a tourist can go to.
I'm always looking for places that are just opening up. And Iraq and Pakistan fit the bill. So last summer I was looking for some interesting places to go. I was had been thinking about West Africa. But then a couple of interesting adventurous women in my life gave me some great ideas. A friend of mine, Jennifer Chan, took her two kids to go hike to K2 base camp. And I noticed her, she was emailing me about it. So I didn't know that Pakistan was open and safe for travel. Figured if she were there with her kids hiking for 2 weeks in the mountains without a signal, that it was fine for me. And then the idea of Northern Iraq came to me because another friend of mine, Manuk Vanishut, runs a vlog called A Bunch of Backpackers. And she posted that she was going to go there last year. And I didn't realize that Northern Iraq was open for traveling. So I put together those two ideas, and I ended up going based on their two ideas.
So and then you mentioned something about the British Backpacking Society.
Yeah, as I began to research both places, I was surprised at how many people were recommending Pakistan. So the British Backpacking magazine made it their top destination, I think in 2018 or something like that. And then so many blogs and vlogs were talking about going there and what incredible hiking it was and how safe it was, and I'm talking about both places. When I research a trip now, it's no longer beginning with the guidebook with Lonely Planet. It's beginning online with bloggers who've been there and video bloggers as well, so I can see where they are. And it just looked amazing. And when I said to people, you know, I wanted to go to Iraq and Pakistan, the initial response was, are you nuts? Like, this is crazy. And yet here I am seeing like a lot of these people, young men, they're women in their mid-20s going there and having a great time and no problems at all. And the more I researched, the more it sounded interesting. And in fact, in doing a search on my podcast app, a Rick Steves podcast even came up talking about Northern Iraq, of all people. I mean, Rick Steves, as we know, basically is the most staid, down-to-earth traveler.
Yeah.
And he had a guest on talking about going there. And I'm not out to take any silly risks when I travel or go to war zones. I know there are some people doing that. My interest is really to go in places that haven't yet been over-touristed. And so Pakistan and Northern Iraq seem to fit that bill really well.
Interesting. So what does it take to get there? Like, you just hop a plane to Northern Iraq, or do they have direct flights to, where did you fly into?
Okay, so I flew through France. So I went and spent the week there. Which ended up being cheaper than flying directly from the U.S. to Erbil, which is the capital of Northern Iraq. For Northern Iraq, you get issued a 30-day visa on arrival. So there's, as a US citizen, and I think even as a EU citizen as well. And that was super easy. Didn't have to do anything in advance. Pakistan was a little bit more complicated. So
you flew into Erbil, and you said Erbil is the capital of Northern Iraq?
Yeah,
so
okay.
Not Baghdad. So,
getting into complicated political issues here. So Iraq is basically all of Iraq, including Northern Iraq. However, the Kurds have been granted autonomy.
Okay.
So the Kurds, that you might remember, they're a U.S. ally. They're they rose up against Saddam Hussein. They were the people we protected with the no-fly zone.
Mm-hmm.
They are a people that's, they've been around for a long time, have a interesting culture, and they're spread across three different countries. So they're spread across Turkey and Iraq and Syria. They're trying to carve out a homeland for themselves, which hasn't made those three countries particularly happy. Iraq has been the most accommodating as far as granting them this autonomy. So
and the autonomy that they're granted, they issue visas. So you fly into their capital,
yep,
and they issue you a visa for when you're there.
And their own currency. And they control security, and they do a great job with security. So that is why if you go to the rest of Iraq as an American, you're in trouble. But if you're in the part of Iraq controlled by the Kurds where I was, Northern Iraq, you're fine. In fact, at one point on the trip, I'm within 50 miles of Mosul, which we all have heard of in the news, and Kirkuk, and which are in the normal part of Iraq, and if I just crossed the Kurdish border down there, I'd be in big trouble. So it was interesting to be that close and to be fine.
So it is important, you say, Northern Iraq.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, Iraq is like, oh, he went to Iraq.
Right.
But there are safe parts, and the safe parts are not necessarily the Iraq we think of, but the Kurdish Iraq in the
yes.
north.
Yes, and it's important to me to be clear, because I don't want to take on any sort of, you know, being more adventurous than I was. I mean, I'm not going to war zones. It was in Northern Iraq. These were in Pakistan, were safe places that I researched ahead of time. So this was not me being a fool and going in the back.
We had a picture of the city you flew into up there, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, pull that up real quick. Where is this?
So this is Erbil. This is the capital of Northern Iraq, or the Kurdish area, their autonomous region. And that's one of their tea rooms. That tea room opened in 1940. It's called Mashka. And you walk in there, and it's a bunch of gentlemen playing cards, backgammon, smoking cigarettes, drinking tea. I went in there and joined them and read a book for a while. When I got to Erbil, it was 113 degrees.
Jeez.
During the day, there are very few people out. People are come out in the morning or after sunset. It gets very crowded.
So what does everybody do in the middle of the day?
They sit inside in air conditioning. So except the tea room wasn't air conditioned. They had ceiling fans. Uh-huh. It was pleasant enough to be in during the day. I mean,
but they're social. They're just inside.
They're very social. So in that area is kind of everything. There's not a lot in Northern Iraq, and there's not a lot in Erbil if you're used to going to, like, say, Rome or Paris, where there's a lot of things to see. But the things that are there to see are interesting. So in addition to the tea room, you're on a square, and the bazaar is there. And behind the tea room is actually the citadel, which is this ancient fort. It's, well, not too ancient. It was built, I read, in the 18th century.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating place to visit. There's a museum up there. There's a military guard post. There's mosque in there as well. And once the sun sets, it's where everybody goes to look over the square and mingle and socialize. Mm. A lot of young people out there. And in the bazaar is open all day, and it's shaded. So you go in there, and there's places to eat, you can buy food, jewelry. And there's really not much tourist infrastructure there at all. I mean, there are a few hotels. There is a hop-on, hop-off, incredibly. But what I found out is it's actually for the tourists that come from Baghdad. So other Iraqis coming to northern Iraq.
So now, how is this place affected by the wars?
So as of now, there really haven't had any problems. I don't know what's happened since the alliance with our government, the U.S. government, split, if they've had more trouble. I am in contact with one guy I met there. He says there aren't really any problems right now, but I don't know. He's just in one town. In the past, they've had some problems with ISIS. I ended up visiting this town called Lalesh, which I'll probably talk more about later. The Yazidis are there. This is an ancient religion. And they were under siege by ISIS back in 2014.
I think you had a picture of one of their temples
in
there.
It's the place with the
yeah, there it is.
The gate. Yeah, that's it. So you go to this town.
So this is another minority religion.
Yeah.
Amongst a minority religion.
Well, the Kurds are not a religion. They're people. They're an ethnic group.
An ethnic group.
Yeah. So the Yazidis have their own religion. And they were under siege at the Mount Sinjar massacre in 2014, where the U.S. had to come basically help them out with air support, and then the Kurdish Peshmerga soldiers came and rescued them, basically. Hmm. I remember it being on the news. But Lalesh is incredibly interesting. You have to take off your shoes at the entrance of the town, at the police checkpoint. So you may be used to, you know, when you go to a Buddhist temple, you take it out at the temple, but the town you can walk around in your sandals or shoes. Now, at the beginning of town, you have to take off your shoes. And I knew this, and so, which is why I went at 8 in the morning so that the ground wouldn't burn my feet when it's 113 degrees out every day. What I didn't know is that I had to also wear long pants. I showed up in my shorts. A cop let me borrow an extra pair of pants. And at this time when we're all trying to stay socially distanced, I'm now thinking about this time where I once borrowed some guy's pants.
No problem, right?
Yeah. No problem. And actually, I think it was even worse, a pair of pants that he probably lent off in the tourists who didn't show up.
This is my pair of tourist pants. Yeah. I wash it every month.
Yeah, sure. I walked around and you go inside and it's inside these temples, it's cave-like. They actually paint the walls black. And there were some young people in there, and they kind of explained to me like how the rituals go. There was this place where you're supposed to pick up a rag and toss it on top of a stone structure about 15 feet away. And if you got it to stick on top of the stone structure, then you get a wish fulfilled. And so they're all taking turns throwing the rag up there. But it was fascinating. You walk around here, an interesting architecture and design. You would ask me to bring 20 photos. It was really hard to narrow it down to 20 photos.
Did I say 20?
Yeah, but there was some great views of the rooftops, which are sort of conical, very interesting designs amongst a landscape that is not too different from the Southern California kind of chaparral brush and stone that you might see, let's say, outside of Palm Springs.
But still like a little bit, okay, outside of Palm Springs. It gets pretty hot out there, too.
Yeah.
Now, you had some pictures of some kids up there. I want to throw those up. Let's take a look at these guys.
Oh, yeah, I had to take a picture of these guys. This is a very popular hairstyle amongst young people there, and I said they were basically kid in play. You were saying Vanilla Ice.
Vanilla Ice, yeah.
Yeah. I stopped these guys. I'm like, please, could I take a picture of you? And they were more than happy. I mean, you can see them smiling.
Yeah.
This was the style there. And I could see them in the hair salons in the bazaar getting their hair done up like that. So.
Huh. So it really seems like, that there was a major war there recently. There mm-hmm. were two major wars. Mm-hmm. And I remember the first one, the Kurds were involved quite a bit. Mm-hmm. So, like, what kind of fallout did you see in that area from...
So there were basically bombed out buildings, and there were buildings full of bullet holes pretty much everywhere, even mm-hmm. in Erbil. I mean, around the center in the bazaar, it had been repaired, but you walk a couple blocks over from where that picture was taken, and there were buildings with bullet holes in them. It's evident. I mean, they've been a great ally against ISIS, which is why the U.S. government had been working with them. It's evident everywhere you go.
So the Kurdish people in northern Iraq, they basically pushed out all of ISIS and got their shit under control pretty quick.
Yeah, they keep things really tight there. There are checkpoints everywhere.
Uh-huh. Check your visa?
Then not really. They were, as an American, because we had helped out the Kurds so much, they loved me. They loved having me there. And it was, I've never been in the U.S. military or anything like that. I had nothing to do with this. But as an American citizen, they were very happy to have me there and treated me very well. So occasionally they would check my visa, but really they just asked for my passport. And then they'd smile and say welcome and hand it right back to me.
Huh. Yeah, that's crazy.
So the checkpoints were really every few miles. I mean, they're really keeping things tight. I mean, they're in a dangerous neighborhood.
So out of Erbil, where did you go from there? you got a car, or do you hire a guide, or what?
Nope, no guide. No, didn't get a car here.
No guide. I like it.
Yeah, I don't like guides. I have to talk to them. You know.
Now, what about, like, you know? I know in a lot of countries, you know, people really push stuff on tourists, and a guide kind of keeps you a little bit insulated from the people in the bazaar trying to sell you everything, right?
This is not a tourist spot. You did not.
So this is like virgin territory, which is rare these days, you know, even in bad areas.
Yep. Exactly. Yeah. This no, hello, my friends. I want to practice my English with you. You know, none of this stuff. The information I got was from online. I didn't even buy a Lonely Planet for this place. You know, I had a cell signal for the, you know, people watching who don't know the world's incredibly connected now. I mean, I get 4G in pretty much every country. And even with my mobile phone plan, they even give me free internet. I think I bought a local. It slowed down, so I did buy a local SIM in Iraq. But there's no need to have a guidebook. If I want to know what something is, I just Google it right from my phone.
That's how you got around. No maps, just Google, and it was that. I'm shocked that it's that good. Like the wireless connectivity. Because I've heard some nations have kind of like leapfrogged, you know, the technology. Mm-hmm. Like we think about all our internet is through like cable and broadband providers, but a lot of countries just went straight over and went to 4G.
Yeah, it's easier to set up wire a cell tower and give people cell phones than it is to set up landlines to everyone's house. So yeah, you're exactly. They skipped that step. They have better cell connections than we do here in the States. I mean, I can't even make a call in downtown LA. But yet, you know, I was in Madagascar in 2015, and there were quite a few towns in the middle of nowhere that had 4G. You know, and I'm following my football team from a bush taxi, basically. But
so were you hitchhiking at this point? Would you say?
So I was hitchhiking and bush taxis. I call them bush taxis, but for those of you who've traveled, you know, developing countries, it's the same thing everywhere. It's a minivan that seats 7 comfortably, but they fit 15 of you in there.
Right.
They go between the towns.
Can you pay for like 2 seats, or do they frown upon that?
I never do that. I've never done that.
Like when you're like, hey, let's buy out this row. I need some space.
I've heard that from travelers. I've never done it for a couple reasons. One is I think it's a cop out. You know, here I am, this privileged American. You know, I'm gonna buy 2 seats, but and therefore I can sort of fit in. I'm in the same boat as everyone there, and also I'm kind of there to see what the locals are doing, right? Uh-huh. I mean, I don't want to be separated. I don't want to be in my tourist bubble. I want to be with them in the same thing and talking to them and getting to know them. And, you know, I'd like to think there's a respect that, you know, I'm not sitting there in a tourist car, air-conditioned tourist car with a guide, that I'm, you know, in the van with them. But that said, you know, the middle class is taking hold there. More and more people are driving between their towns in their own cars. Hmm. And the roads are good there. And you go to these, what they call garages, and it's where these bush taxis leave from. And they're giant, but there are very few minivans there leaving, which basically tells me that in the past, they had to be that big for the amount of people who are getting from town to town in these minivans. But now that so many people have their own cars, there are fewer people who have to travel this way. And I had to wait quite a while on occasion to get a car.
They basically wait till it's full and then they go? Yeah,
exactly.
Will they like text you so you can go like have tea?
No, but there usually was somebody selling tea in nearby. I wasn't. And there's shade. I mean, it's hot. And, you know, you can sit inside. And a lot of these people had air conditioners. So even, like, at the garages, the drivers might be waiting in a room that was air conditioned. So I just go sit in there with them. There's a television on in there showing, you know, an action movie translated into Kurdish, you know.
Yeah.
So there was some air conditioning around. These minivans were, in fact, air conditioned. In one case, when I was leaving Slamani, the minivan was waiting with the engine off, so the air conditioning couldn't run. So what they did was they had an air conditioning unit that they stuck in a duct through one of the window to keep us cool while we were waiting to leave.
I guess that you have to do that, right?
When it's 113 degrees out, yeah. I mean, it's just, you just die sitting in the car otherwise.
I can imagine. Yeah. That's miserable.
Yeah. So to the next town, which was So I took a minivan out of Erbil to Acre. I heard there was a beautiful waterfall there. There was indeed a waterfall there, but the Iraqis, probably because of the heat, turn all their waterfalls into amusement parks. So it's not a pristine waterfall. People are selling ices there. Kids are jumping in and out. It's all concreted over. You can eat lunch and go swim. It's basically a public pool.
I mean, that's an interesting use of a natural resource, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's one way to do it. Because, mm-hmm. you know, in the United States, we've got the national park system. So if we have anything of value in nature, it's a national park. We got to protect it. But we do to a certain extent. Because, you know, if you go to any one of our national parks, you can drive your car all over it.
Right.
You know, you drive your car right up to the edge of the Grand Canyon and look in. But that's interesting that in Iraq, they're like, hey, this waterfall, we need to use this thing.
Yeah, no idea of trying to preserve the natural beauty of it. But, you know, it's probably been like that for probably millennia. I mean, when it's that hot in that area, they're like, great.
Now, what is this water fed by? Where's the water coming from?
Coming from the mountains? I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, there are mountains in the area, so it must be coming from melting snow cap somewhere. I don't know.
It's continuous flow. Like, you got this picture of the bridge up here. That water actually looks really good. Where is that?
So that's in Zuko, which is a town I went to near Duhok. And in this case, because there wasn't public transportation, from Duhok, I hired a taxi. Take me to Lalesh, the town I mentioned, the Yazidis, and then drop me off at this place. And I walked around and I saw that bridge, which reminds me of the bridge at Mostar. And I went to a tea room and I met a gentleman who spoke English, who, again, was very happy to have an American around. Local wanted to show me around. Told me about his grandfather that escaped from a 300-year-old prison and by jumping from the prison into that river that you just saw. Hmm. Interesting guy. We hung out for a couple hours and walked around, and then I caught a minibus back to Duhok. So that's that town. Oh, that bridge. There were young kids jumping off of it.
Let's see that again. Wait.
I don't know if you can see. Yeah, you can sort of
from
see
the center span.
Yeah,
so they were dropping into that little. I mean, I guess it's deep there. It looks like the rocks are pretty deep.
They were jumping from the middle and then also from the top. It was rather incredible.
Oh wow!
And I took video of it, which I don't have with me. But I wanted to do it, but I was by myself and I didn't know who was going to hold my wallet and passport.
Yeah.
While I jumped in the water.
Or who's going to pull you out of the water when you hit a rock?
Yeah, exactly.
All the locals know where the rock is, but
except me. Yeah. Yeah. Who's going to take me to the hospital?
But that looked like really clean water.
The water.
Surprising.
Yeah, I guess. I mean,
it looks clean.
They treat these rivers kind of like open sewers, but you know, it's. In that part, it was pretty clear. You could see into it. So yeah.
So what else did you do in northern Iraq?
So the couple of interesting things. So from Duhok, I went to Amedi, which is this ancient town from like built 25th century BC, believe it or not.
25th century.
Yep.
So.
Yep. I double checked that on Wikipedia before coming here to make sure that was right.
So basically, 2500 before zero.
Yep. Before Christ, exactly. And it, because of its strategic location, it's built on top of a mountain.
Uh-huh.
And so I took a bush taxi there and walked around for a couple hours. I saw the citadel, not too much left of the ancient structures. There was kind of a gate left. Again, I went to a tea room and I ended up meeting some locals. There was one fellow there around the bingo parlor, spoke English, really nice, gave me some history of the place. From there, I had the hitchhike. And I was trying to get all the way to a town called Soran that night. And I was told it was very unlikely that I would do it. So I caught a ride out of town.
So what's that? Wait, what's hitchhiking look like?
It's standing by the side of the road with your thumb up.
That's it? Just like on the side of town? You're like, anybody going that way? You're like, I need to go down this road?
Yeah. And in fact, I think I just said something wrong. I think it's not thumb up. I think you, as I recall, I go like that, basically, the way the car is down.
Uh-huh.
And so I got a ride out of town. And then I got a second ride, and the guy took me about 2 hours more. And he said, look, I'll take you all the way to Soran if you pay me this outrageous price. And he was the only person I kind of had any trouble with. And I'm like, no, I really don't want to pay that much. And I tried to bargain him down, and he wouldn't go any further. And then he says, well, you're not going to find the ride at this hour, I guarantee you. You're either going to be stuck in this small town or you're going to have to pay me. So I'm like, oh, really? Well, let's see. So I walked 100 yards down the road, and in about 2 minutes, I had another ride. So, bye.
Yeah, it wasn't worth it to him, right? Yeah. Now, but wait, stuck in that small town, what's lodging look like in a small town?
I don't know.
No clue? Like,
in that one, I don't know. But there would be places to stay, and hotels are not that cheap there. There aren't really tourists.
Now, what do you mean not that cheap?
Like, it would be probably $40, $50 a night, maybe.
Okay.
It was, just to give you an idea, like, I stayed at the cheapest hotel in Erbil, and that was $25 a night. In Duhok, I had to walk around quite a bit, and I found a cheap hotel for $45.
What's the most expensive hotel?
That was it in Duhok, the $45.
Yeah. And what do you get for $45 a night?
You get a room with an air conditioner that works sporadically throughout the night, and a drop toilet that smells, and with a shower head just over it. So,
okay.
Yeah, and the bed with basically a sheet, not like you need any more when it's that hot there, but the sheet has a hole in it, so I turned it around so the hole was near my foot side. Just worry about bed bugs and fleas all night. So
that's for $45.
That's for $45 a night.
So you're traveling with a backpack and a sleep sack or what?
No, I did bring my sleeping bag liner, which I often do to these places, because when I'm in a place where I'm on a sketchy mattress, at least I can put that between me. Mm-hmm. But there it was just so hot, and with the air conditioner not working, I slept on top of it. And it's not that big. But anyways, I didn't get...
So then what does $25 a night get you?
You know, the best deal I got was in the town I was heading to in Saran. I found the Hotel Diana. I remember the name of it. It's like said it was a 4-star hotel. It was pretty nice for Iraq.
The star ratings are relative, right?
Yeah, but it was a business hotel. And it was a nice room. And it was $25. I don't know how. not that I'm into staying in nice hotels in these places, but I'm like, hey, for $25, especially after the crap I was staying in, I'm happy to have a clean place. So, that was the best I'd run into.
So what does that look like? Was it, I'm super interested in seeing how far your money goes.
Well, like I said, it was a business hotel. So maybe like imagine, you know, a Marriott style hotel, but run down.
A rundown Marriott.
Yeah.
Okay.
So in other words, you're going to have a business-style room. It's got a double bed. It's got air conditioning. It's got a bathroom with a Western-style toilet. There's a TV in there with a satellite and stuff. The other thing is, like I say, it's not like there's a backpacker place to go stay at either.
Right.
You know? And indeed, the lesser quality hotels were not that much cheaper. I mean, maybe it would have been $18 to go stay in a crappy hotel. So mm-hmm. There's only one place in Iraq where they have a backpacker style hotel. It's in Soleimani, and it's called the Dolphin. And I did go stay there, and I got a cheap room, bathroom inside, or was it down the hall? But it, like I said, it was a European style backpacker place. The only
right.
one I think in the country, at least as of last year. So.
So where'd you head from there?
So
we took a little detour down what hotels look
yeah,
like, which
yeah.
I'm sure people love to hear, right? Like everybody, what's it like there, you know?
Yeah, it's a good question. I get these questions a lot. So what I did, I was in Saran to do a hike in what's called Rowandiz Canyon. Funny thing, because I kept reading online that there's great hiking there. And I didn't realize that all the bloggers I read who said it didn't actually do the hike. They're like, oh, we couldn't find the trail. Or it was rainy and they were afraid they were going to slip.
And this is the trail? You could throw that picture up there.
That's the trail.
That's, I would count that as a good trail. I can see where that trail goes.
Yeah, most of it was easy and okay. This part was the only part that was a little sketchy because it's kind of steep and that's loose terrain. So mm-hmm. you didn't want to lose your footing, but it was fairly safe. I'm not trying to oversell this. But.
And where did this trail go?
Okay, so I went to a waterfall. And this wasn't... I went to the canyon and I could not find a trail or any signs for trail and no one knew of it. So I basically followed the river and I followed that picture that was up there. I don't think it was open to the public. I'd say that because I had to climb a fence at one point. And then I got to another fence where I had to crawl through a hole.
Huh.
That day it was a little cooler. It was 103 degrees. But I'm thinking to myself, Here I am in a canyon in Iraq on what I don't think is a trail, climbing through a fence.
And no signs though, right?
No signs, but I knew where I was going. As I said, you know, I have a cell signal, so I could, you know, follow my maps me, no problem. And you get to the end and there's a waterfall there, which guess what, is an amusement park.
Really? So everybody went in through that trail or they come in?
They come in through a proper road on the other side.
Oh, okay.
So when I arrived, they're all there picnicking and, you know, eating junk food, pizza, hot dogs, you know, everything. And here I come wandering off the hill with a backpack, you know, this white guy down, climbing down this loose terrain and everyone staring at me. But it felt
do people think like you're a spook or something, you know, like a random white guy your age, you know, wandering through Iraq? I'd be like, hey, look at the CIA or something.
No.
What's he doing? Maybe that's why they don't mess with you, right?
Yeah.
No, but they're like, is that your drone?
Yeah, exactly. No issues. Nobody suspected me at all. They just, again, I'm not the only tourist coming through, but there aren't many.
How often would you run into another Westerner? Or European, or, you know, basically, because you did mention that lots of people, like people from Baghdad, would come up as tourists to northern Iraq.
Right. Westerners, okay. So
Westerners, Europeans, Russians, I don't know, Chinese.
So some are there. So I saw one in Erbil as I was eating dinner. A woman walked by. I didn't talk to her. And then at the Dolphin, the backpacker place in Slamati, there was another Westerner staying there, but I didn't talk to him. And then that's
about
it. You
give him like the nod, like the customary like colonialist, like.
Yeah.
I see you're out here too.
He wasn't that friendly of a guy, I have to say. I did say hi to him and he just kind of looked at me. He was really loaded with tattoos, actually. He looked like he would be
a spook.
Be from Los Another Feliz spook. Or something, yeah. You know, like a hipster type sitting there in the common area, yeah. Screwing around with his cell phone. But there are other tourists, because like I said, other vloggers, I mentioned, you know, my friends who went. I have another friend who's a good traveler, Justin. He was there about a month after me. Mm-hmm. And then on Instagram, I kept seeing people showing up in Erbil at that view of the citadel. The women and these vloggers, women in their mid-20s, you know, who have these channels there in Erbil looking over this place. So, you know.
Next greatest thing, right?
Yeah.
It's just opening up, so you got to get there.
Exactly. But it's funny because, you know, here I tell people here I went to Iraq. I'm like, oh, you're crazy. Like, you're such an adventurer. And then, you know, here are these, you know, cute young girls making videos there. No problem at all.
Selling water or something like that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah, so no, I didn't. But more so when I got to Pakistan, there were more tourists there. So,
what else in Iraq? You did the hike. Oh, this was interesting. What was this?
This was in Slamani. This was Saddam Hussein's one of his prisons.
I bet some bad shit went down in that place.
Yeah, and you talk about bullet holes, like it's full of it, because there was an uprising, and they basically attacked this prison. But now it's a museum. These tanks are part of the museum, and they have display there of the people who are prisoners, the people who are killed either in the prison or trying to liberate the prison. Hmm. And they have a very moving area. You go in, it's like this mirror and these points of light representing all the people who died, caused by Saddam Hussein. And in fact, I ended up going through the town where the Kurdish uprising started. It was called Ranya. And they had in 1991 an uprising there, and they're very proud that that's the town where it started. So, I had run out of local currency there, and a pharmacist there who spoke pretty good English helped me change money, find a place to change money there. Basically, in this town, completely out of dinars, and it was very helpful.
And there's no like. You know, dual currency, like they'll accept euros or dollars or anything like that. It's all local.
Yeah, and there wasn't an ATM in that town at all. It was just I had some cash on me to change. I just need to find a place to change.
Old school traveler's checks.
Yeah. No traveler's checks.
No traveler's checks.
No way. Those are even worse than like, that's got to be
impossible.
Worst.
Everybody's like, I don't want to deal with that
crap.
Yeah,
nobody's. Yeah. I haven't
Bitcoin.
Yeah, and do you take Bitcoin? Apple Pay?
Yeah, Apple Pay. Yeah. So how did you get it? So the trip was northern Iraq and Pakistan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, geography's, I don't know the geography that well. I was in the Navy. I was never over there, right? So, like, if it's not on the water. But I kind of assumed that, you know, you cross the border. But then I looked at them and it's a fairly big separation. There's several countries in between the two, right?
Yeah.
So how'd you get over to Pakistan?
Yeah, it really wasn't a matter of, you know, geography that I, it just, these were two places I wanted to hit together. So I got a flight with Air Arabia. It was a really lousy flight. I flew out of Erbil. It was hours and hours, a lot of sitting in airports. I went through Sanjar, which is in UAE, and then landed in Karachi at 2 a.m.
So UAE, now, if my job, that's the wrong direction. Okay, so you flew there, and then
east, yeah. Then to Karachi. You got to Karachi. I had no desire to visit. I heard lots of bad things about Karachi, and there were more interesting things to visit. The bad things being just, you know, there was some interesting British colonial stuff there. I heard, but otherwise, it's just an overcrowded, hot, dirty town. Tried to get some money at ATM at an airport, and the ATM machine ate my ATM card. Which I'm told is extremely common. And I called up the phone at the ATM, furious at the guy. And he's like, well, there's a law in Pakistan that if they notice anything suspicious with your card, I don't know what it was, the machine's supposed to keep it. Well, how do I get it back? I'm like, well, you got to go to the bank. I'm like, I can't. I got a flight in 4 hours. So again, I had no local currency, and I had no ATM card. So I had to basically spent most of the night on the phone with my with Citibank trying to see if I could get another card sent to me in Pakistan. Huh. Long story short, I dropped by Citibank in Islamabad. They said they couldn't help me. What I ended up doing was wiring money to myself through Western Union. Hmm. So I just went on the Western Union website, and with a credit card, I wired myself some money. Went to
That's good to know, though, that in some countries, the ATM may steal your card.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that happens all the time, right? Like, in terms of, like, something fishy with your ATM card or credit card, like, shoot, if I buy gas in the wrong place, it'll kick my card.
Right. And I'm told the way to avoid this, and what I should have done, for any of you traveling there, is you only use your ATM cards at an ATM at a bank during banking hours. So that if the ATM at the bank eats it, the bank's open, you just go inside and get it.
Right. So general good ATM practice, don't use this shady ATM that's in like
an airport.
In a cage a 7-Eleven or whatever. So you finally made it to Abbottabad, right?
Yeah, so I landed in Islamabad. Islamabad, sort of interesting one day there. Mosque, viewpoint, a historic town. I rented a car to basically drive the Karakoram Highway, a famous part of the
Silk Road. So you rented a car in Islamabad?
Yep. I rented it from Hertz, and it took me 3 hours to find the Hertz because they did not have a sign out front. And when I finally found it, I complained, and they said, well, we're not allowed to have a sign out front. Well, how am I supposed to find you? He's like, well, here's the address. And I said, well, here's the address that I got from Hertz. And I showed it to them. They're like, oh, that's our old address.
Tracks right about on.
Yeah. And this is why I say this kind of reminds me of what it used to be like to travel before it became so easy with the internet. Like, this is kind of a bit old school where everything wasn't so slam dunk. Anyways. Got the car, rented it for 12 days to drive myself. Stick shift, driving on the other side of the road. I mean, I'm a pretty decent driver. But I have to say, like, if driving were a video game, Pakistan's the highest level. I mean, they are so aggressive there. And the roads are narrow and dangerous. Drove out of Islamabad, and I wanted to go just that night to Abbottabad, which you might remember is the town where Osama bin Laden was hiding out and where the Navy SEALs killed him. Which I'll talk about.
We have a picture of Abbottabad, right? Looks like a great place.
It's beautiful. This is representative of Abbottabad. So this was on my way to dinner from my hotel as I was trying to walk down the non-existent sidewalk. And this is what it looks like.
Now, that's pretty much the town. Abbottabad's like basically, if I remember from the news, it's like the military academy for Pakistan is there, right?
Yeah, it's a military town. The villa where Osama was hanging out has been razed, and you can't visit there.
So they erased it. They're just it. Like,
And they don't want you visiting if you're from, I read that online. I didn't even try because they said like the ambassador from Norway or Sweden or whatever went there with his family to see it. And they arrested him, an ambassador, quickly released him, and then booted him out of the country.
Wow.
That's how much they don't want you to look at it. Anyway, so I didn't try, but I'll tell you, driving there, if you're not being aggressive, you're not getting anywhere.
Yeah.
It's up and down hills, it's construction, it's traffic, people driving on the wrong side. You know, massive traffic getting into Abbottabad. I was like ready to abandon the car and just sit by the side of the road and cry for the rest of the day.
I mean, it's tough, right? Like, you know, there's places you drive where it's just, you've got to be on the whole time.
Yeah.
And that's what it sounds like. Like, you know, drive down to Orange County and the freeways are great. They're nice and wide. You drive down the street, everybody's chill, right?
Yeah.
But then you go into a city and it's just like, this is like you're tight on the wheel, right?
Yeah, and it's not just like Abbottabad was the worst, but the whole highway's, you know, like this.
And how long of a drive was it for you?
To Abbottabad, it's only 82 miles and it took me maybe 5 hours.
Okay.
Just from Islamabad. The whole route to the Chinese border is 487 miles.
And so, did you do that?
Yeah, I drove all the way to the Chinese border and back to Islamabad over 11 days, and I got the car back to Hertz without a scratch, miraculously.
Wow. Do we have a picture of that highway? I think there's...
Yeah, there are some pictures, quite a few, because that's the bulk of my time in Pakistan was on that highway.
There it is. So that's the highway?
That's the highway. That's one of the pictures. So this is a part near Rakop Bridge, where basically two trucks tried to pass each other going the other way and got stuck. You can see one side is the side of a mountain. The other side is a cliff that is a sheer drop into the river.
I mean, that looks like a nice road.
That's a dirt road, and there are parts that are paved, and then there are parts that are really bad.
Aside from the two giant trucks stuck there, like that, I'd feel good driving around. So what do? You just stop? You're like, oh, well, we're going to be here for an hour or so.
We waited, everyone on the road, and as that truck tried to back out, and you can see that was a tanker. A fuel tanker. And as it's backing, they're separating them, you could hear the metal scraping. And they're like, I think I'm going to stand.
What was the other one? What was that other vehicle?
It was a typical truck. It just was carrying whatever. But, I mean, it's the tanker I'm worried about, the flammable tanker. And I had met a Spanish guy at that time on a motorbike. And he and I are like, let's stand farther away. They got them separated.
So you did that whole highway about 500 miles.
Yeah, I did. And it got better as you got past this major town called Gilgit. So as you got more into the mountains, there was less traffic, fewer of those trucks. But a lot of the problem was those trucks, when you're behind them, are super slow and you got to pass. So you're doing a lot of dangerous passing on that road as well. And as I said, you know, it's like they drive on the left there. And I'm driving a stick shift, which meant I had to shift with my left hand. I mean, I did it, but it was just not something I was used to.
Right.
So, yeah.
It's not natural.
Not natural, yeah.
Huh. Okay, here's another picture of a road. Did you drive that?
No. So what this was, this was quite a road.
Damn.
So I was on the way to a hike at Fairy Meadows up to Nanga Parbat. And
what is that drop?
It's about 1,000 feet.
Just...
Yeah.
Oh my God.
So, I can't take my car on the road. You know, I rented a Toyota, but fortunately, I mentioned there was that Spanish guy I met, Nico, and then I picked up a Serbian hitchhiker, a woman, and the three of us combined to hire a Jeep to go up that road. You got to hire these Jeeps to go up because you know this road's incredibly dangerous, and you need a 4x4, not a Toyota sedan.
How I would have walked that thing, man. I wouldn't want to be in some Jeep driven, you know.
It's a 2-hour Jeep ride, so it's not really that walkable. That said, there were locals walking it along the way.
Yeah, because they don't trust the Jeeps. They've seen too many Jeeps go off that road.
Now,
the guy texting while driving, or was he a pretty good driver?
He was a good driver. And, you know, I mean, those Jeeps are obviously stick shifts, and he handled it masterfully. I asked him if any Jeeps had ever gone off the road, and he said no. But I had heard from other people that that's not true, that no tourists in a Jeep have ever gone off the road.
No tourists have ever gone.
Some Jeeps have fallen off the side.
But of course the Jeep driver is going to say that. And of course the people are going to say that. Oh yeah, you tourists are safe. It's fine.
Yeah, yeah.
No problems. Jeez.
The two people I split the cost of the Jeep with, they had me ride in front on the way up.
I would have ridden in whatever side's on the hillside, right? Uh-huh. Like, so I could have my hand on that handle the whole time, just like ready to, here we go. So you took off on this Jeep ride to go on a hike?
Yeah, so the Jeep starts at Rock Up Ridge, 2 hours up to a beginning of a hiking trail. You hike 2 more hours up to a place called Fairy Meadows. And this is beautiful. And if you have that photo with the Pakistani flag and the glacier in the background, that is, that's it. That's Fairy Meadows. So this is a part that's sort of becoming touristy. There are some lodges here. And I stayed in a lodge, and that was a view very close to my room.
What altitude are you at this point?
I think around 10,000, so maybe 11, somewhere around there.
It's such a shift to go from northern Iraq and all this desert hotness to glaciers.
Yeah, and indeed, Pakistan was pretty hot, but once you got up to that altitude, it was cool. And at night it was cold, so I knew it would be, and I did have some warm clothes with me just for these hikes. It was a great place to stay. A bunch of locals barbecued a goat over a fire one of the nights. But the hike was the highlight. So I got up the next morning and I hiked up to Nanga Parbat Base Camp. Nanga Parbat, for climbers watching, is the ninth tallest mountain in the world. It's 29,600 or
29,000?
No, sorry, I'm wrong. 26,000.
So, 26.
Yeah. 26,000 feet. And anyways, you can hike to the base camp, and it's a beautiful hike. You hike through some villages along that glacier that you saw in the photo. And it's about a 5-hour hike up. There are quite a few tourists there. You have to scramble over a glacier at some point, which is really fun. And they recommend you get a guide. I didn't get a guide. And I was on the glacier, and I wouldn't say lost, because I knew where it was. It was just I kind of lost the trail through the glacier. And some guy, local, saw me and came up and started yelling at me that I should get a guide, and too many people get lost and die. And I'm like, whatever. I had found the trail by that point. The trail was marked by a bunch of cairns, which weren't immediately obvious against the white background of the gray and white background of the glacier. But crossing over that glacier was cool because it was collapsing kind of all around you in the heat.
Wow.
There's water flowing through it, and you'd be
That does sound a bit
there.
Dangerous.
It does sound it. I mean,
people fall in those crevasses and they're like hundreds of feet deep, right?
It wasn't that kind of glacier that it would be hundreds of feet deep, maybe 20 or 30 feet, but still, it wouldn't have been a good thing. So there's water running through and it's melting, and you would hear calving and crashes every once in a while. It was from around you. You wouldn't necessarily see where it came from. Like, I'd be walking in a crevice and I'd hear this explosion, basically, and like somewhere it's part of the glacier, it collapsed. But I got through it, and it was fine. And you know, when you get to the base camp, there's some guys there who will cook you lunch. So they cooked me lentils for lunch. I did another short hike around the area, and then I came back the same day. Long hike, beautiful, really took my time coming back. I mean, these Fairy Meadows, it really did look like something out of like The Hobbit or The Shire, where fairies would hang out.
When you think Pakistan, you don't think of that at all, right?
No, well, yeah, initially. But when I did my research before going, I mean, it was just such a recommended backpacker destination, you know?
And this is a picture. What's this a picture of here?
So this is off the Karakoram Highway later on. This is near a town called Pasu. And there, I could have sent you 100 pictures just as beautiful as this one. I mean, it just... My computer's full of them. It was hard to choose. I mean, it's just such a beautiful drive with these majestic landscapes all around. Huh. So after that hike, came back down, Jeep ride back down, continued driving through Gilgit, which was sort of the main town in the area. and stayed one night there, continued on to from there to a town called Sost, which is near the Chinese border, and then went to the Chinese border.
We have a picture of that Chinese border. What were you saying? This is like the highest border?
The highest.
Yeah, that's it.
Highest paved road border, because I'm sure there are probably some higher ones that are like a trail or something. This is 15,370 feet.
And what are all these people are walking across it?
These are
what?
Pakistani tourists.
Oh, wow.
So you're allowed to get out and walk around. I was rather surprised. I had to ask the border guards twice if I could walk in there. No problem.
So there's nothing around here. Go for it.
There was 200 people there. And you go, they walk all the way to the Chinese border, which is that thing you saw in the background. And, you know, wasn't much cross-border traffic. Maybe a couple trucks passed when I was there. A Chinese family was crossing over from China into Pakistan. It was really interesting area. And of course you saw the signs, there. It said that if you continued on that road, you go to Urumqi and eventually Kashgar. Really interesting part of the world. This was an ancient part of the Silk Road, the Karakoram Highway. And then you can see the road there is pretty nice. The Chinese are basically working with Pakistan to turn that into a regular highway, turning once curvy roads into, building bridges so that they're straight. They want to make it as easy as possible to trade with China. You know, it's all part of this bridge and road initiative.
Interesting.
So there's a lot of construction going on there. So on the Karakoram, you saw a lot of the parts of the road were nice. A lot of them were not. But at some point, you know, if you want to do it, go quickly, because in probably about 3 to 5 years, it's going to be a superhighway going through this area.
What do you think the average speed was on those roads? Like less than 20 miles an hour? It took you a while to get.
To get to about it took me a while. It did open up a little bit after. And those who've driven with me know I'm a bit of an aggressive driver. I guess I was going about 50 miles per hour in a lot of places. I'd slow down for villages and stuff. Wasn't too bad. You know, if you get stuck, once you got past Abbottabad and even Chilis, it started to open up, and even more after Gilgit.
Right.
Fewer and fewer trucks and fewer cars. So
where'd you go after you went up to this border?
Turned around. So I didn't have a Chinese visa. And
so that's like the end of the...
That was my goal anyways. I wanted to see it. I heard it was a beautiful drive. You know, it was very high altitude, and just started heading back. I went basically straight down to to Hamza, the Hunza Valley, which is kind of the tourist hub for Pakistan. When I say it's a tourist hub, it's not like a tourist hub you'd find in Italy. It's, you know, there are hotels there, but it's not overcrowded. I mean, I was there in August of last year.
What do people go there to see?
To see the mountains, to see the culture. There are two forts there. There's some nice hiking in the area. There are some, the rivers. I got a hotel, $18 a night with a beautiful view over the valley.
So since we're on hotels, what are the hotels like there? What do you get for $18 a night? You get a view.
I got a view.
Which is fantastic.
That was one of the nicest places I stayed, because, you know, you have normal kind of, it's a tourist destination, so you can get a cheap, decent hotel for decent. I mean, it's not.
So what is decent?
It's a fairly clean room with a bed that didn't have fleas, a front porch that overlooked the valley,
okay,
with a couple of chairs, decent, okay Wi-Fi, bathroom in the room with a Western-style toilet and a shower. One of those showers, you know, in this part of the world, the shower just basically goes all over the floor of the bathroom, which I have a mixed opinion on. I mean, in one sense, it gets the floor completely wet, but on the other hand, it keeps the floor clean.
I've seen that too. You know, down in Mexico, they have a lot of stuff like that, you know, and if you're only staying one night, who cares?
Yeah.
If you stay in multiple nights, you're like, I guess I'm gonna dry this out or whatever, you know. But if they give you enough towels, right, and you don't have to clean it up, like.
Yeah, they leave plastic sandals by the door that everyone, all the guests use.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so
for the shower?
For the shower, but also after you've taken a shower when it's wet, so that you go into the bathroom, you don't get your feet wet when you get back in the bed, you know, if you're going to use it in the middle of the night.
Makes sense.
But Hunza, they had some restaurants and coffee shops. And you know, like I said, it was kind of the first place with this kind of, you know, more of a tourist infrastructure. And
now, this bridge is in Hunza, right?
It's near it. So this is in a town called Husseini. And this is the world's most dangerous bridge.
So there's a fairly famous bridge here, right? And it looks like the Temple of Doom, the Indiana Jones Bridge.
Yes.
But the Temple of Doom Bridge was nicer, I feel like.
I think it was, yeah. This one had metal wires, so it was a little harder to cut them with the machete.
Right, cable. So what's the deal with this bridge? Where's it going? It looks super long.
Yeah, it goes across to another town across this river. The slats, as you can see, are a bit spaced out. Which
yeah, they look like looks like there's like 2 feet of gap in between each one of those slats. No, maybe not 2 feet.
I mean, this really didn't bother me that much. I've had some of my friends look at this and go, oh no, they weren't going to cross it. Whatever, you hold on to a wire and you just step from slat to slat. The bridge isn't really open to tourists. I guess they had an accident a couple weeks before. A guy wouldn't let me go on the bridge. I talked and letting me go halfway. That said, the Serbian hitchhiker that I mentioned earlier, she told me later that she went at another time and was able to cross with a Japanese tourist. Nobody bothered them.
Some guy he didn't have like a badge on. He was just like the bridge guy.
No, he had a badge on. So he was an official bridge monitor or whatever. So he was legit. It just for whatever reason they crossed when maybe he was at lunch or something or at prayer.
That's the bridge monitor goes to lunch and the bridge is fine.
Yeah, you know? And
otherwise, if he happens to be there, you might get turned away.
Yeah, which should have been my strategy. But it's interesting because when you travel to these countries, this is often what happens. You get lucky and
right.
Sometimes it seemed like on this trip that. Fortune wasn't favoring me in that regard, that I kept running into the officials who were stopping me from doing things, you know?
So did you get to at least go a little bit of ways across the
bridge? Yeah, I walked about halfway, but it sounded interesting because what she told me was on the other side is a village. And in fact, it's hard to see in the picture there, but you cross and then cut out of the hill they cut some stairs out of the rock, basically. So you go up a rock cliff, and then you're at a village, and they walk through that, and then they reached another bridge, and they crossed over. Hmm. Like, oh, man, gee, I wish I had done that.
You know? That does sound cool.
Yeah.
But I can see how they wouldn't want tourists. I mean, it's a working bridge. I mean, it's a famous bridge, mm-hmm. but it's a working bridge. They have it there. It's not there for tourists to take pictures. It's there for people to get back and forth.
Yeah, and I also heard that in that village, the people didn't want tourists wandering through. That said, my friend said that they were quite friendly when they were over there. So,
yeah,
I don't know.
Yeah, so that I because you said earlier, I think that Pakistan was really friendly to American tourists.
Very, very friendly to really Western tourists in general. And this has been, you know, in both Iraq and Northern Iraq and in Pakistan. In fact, the people there all the time came up and asked me, like, oh, where are you from? Like, I'm from America. Welcome. What do you think of Pakistan? Do you think we're all terrorists? A lot of people actually ask me that. And I'm like, well, you know, I mean, the news tells us one thing, I would say, but, you know, I don't think so, or I wouldn't be here. And I said, everyone's been incredibly nice to me. And what they do is, it's traditional offer as host tea to their guests. I drank so much tea there. Everyone was so nice to me everywhere I went in Pakistan. And it really felt like they were almost like cognizant of, you know, this bad, unfair image that Pakistan mm-hmm. was getting and tried extra hard to compensate for that. You know, it really made me feel bad for them that so many people were trying to be like, really, I'm not a terrorist, you know? It's like,
yeah, you know, that's interesting because, you know, when I've traveled too, you know, you meet people and you definitely have preconceived, like if you're like, oh, what happened in Pakistan? Yeah, that's where Bin Laden was. And it seems like they're really trying to get over the Bin Laden thing. Mm-hmm. But most people that you meet, you're like, well, what's that guy doing? Oh, he's Pakistani. He's a terrorist. No, he's not a terrorist. He's a shopkeeper.
Yeah.
Like, what does he do? Same thing that the guy at the 7-Eleven next to your house does back in America. Or, you know, whatever his job is, that's what he did. Oh, he's a photographer, just like the photographers we have here, you know?
You make an excellent point, and it's something I really want to emphasize and try to tell people when I travel, is that most everyone in the world is like you and me. They're going to work, they're going to school, they have no interest in this extremist stuff. And even like countries that we might have been at war with, are at war with, it really seems like the governments that are causing the problem, because it's the small minority that makes all the noise that are the bad guys. Most everyone else is so friendly and welcoming.
And just doing their thing.
Just doing their thing. And it, yeah. You know, it's wonderful. As I said, I can't tell you how wonderful everyone was to me in Pakistan. It was really great. I mean, just before I gave this talk, a Pakistani traffic cop whom I became friends with in Lahore sent me a note wishing me good luck when I posted it on Facebook.
Oh, cool.
And that was just, you know, that sort of welcoming and friendliness was heartwarming. You know, they were really great there.
Yeah, that does sound great. So what else did you do in Pakistan? What's this? This looks like a...
That was in Hunza. As I mentioned, there were a couple forts there.
And these are ancient forts. What were you saying that... How old was this one?
I don't think they're super ancient. Maybe a couple hundred years old.
Oh, that's you know? It? A couple hundred years? Shoot, it'd be a historical monument in Southern California.
Yeah. You know, don't quote me on that. I think it's been rebuilt a few times. If someone's watching this who is knowledgeable, you know, please comment on the video if I've said this wrong. But yeah, they are, you know, they're basically made of wood and mud. So, but they're fascinating to visit, and it's where the Sultan in the area used to live there. And in fact, there's still the family is still in the area, but they live in a modern house now.
So how's that work? You said there's a Sultan?
Yeah.
Is a Sultan like a local provincial governor or something like that, or...?
Well, they were the local noblemen, you know, back in the day. And indeed, that the family whose descendants of the family that built that fort are in the area, and they're still well known. And what's fascinating is right near there is actually Swat in the Swat Valley, which you might recall were a problem back, about 20 years ago. It was sort of a terrorist were in control of the area. You know, there was a Sultan there as well, which made me think of Babe Ruth, who was the Sultan of Swat. So there actually is a Swat, and there's actually a Sultan there. So
there you go. That's it. Where'd you go from there?
Continued down and did another hike, another really great hike to another glacier.
Wow, pop this up there, Andy.
That's... Yeah, Rakaposhi Glacier. And I went to a town called Minipin. Parked the car, and with the Spanish guy I met on the motorbike, Nico, he and I did this hike together. And this was an incredible glacier. In fact, there's a little, you can't see in the picture, but there's a little bit of red in it. So one blogger described it as psychedelic, and it truly is. I mean, he and I hiked up there. It wasn't a super long hike, but it was pretty steep. I think he and I made it in record time. It only took us 3.5 hours. We were told like 5 or 6 hours. And we stayed there for a good hour and a half, just ate our lunch and just enjoyed the view. Wow, just a spectacular glacier. Really enjoyed that hike.
So this really, these two countries really were like untouched by the tourist taint, so to speak.
There like, is tourism, but not, it, it's
it,
not.
It hasn't gotten to that level where it's ruined the culture.
Yeah.
Huh. So I guess the lesson is if you're looking for a cool place to go, Northern Iraq, Pakistan are both safe and extremely interesting.
Yes, exactly. I really recommend both places. I mean, once the world opens up again, go. Go before the other tourists figure out it's safe.
Right.
Hurry up, you know? So yeah, I can't recommend it enough. So.
Well, thank you for coming on the show. Is there any other stories that you want to tell that I left out?
I just really quickly add that after the Karakoram Highway, I went to Peshawar, which you couldn't go there 2 years ago. But
I think we have a picture. This is a good one to bring up.
Yeah.
Bring up, yeah.
So you can tell they're not used to tourists. So here I am basically a nobody in Los Angeles, but in Peshawar, to be a Westerner walking the streets, it's like being a Hollywood star. People would run out of their stores to want to take a selfie with me. And again, you can see the hospitality as well. There the Khyber Pass is nearby, and also the famous gun market. Both were closed for Ashura. Another instance
The gun market.
You might have seen this on 60 Minutes a few years ago. There's a gun market that's famous outside of Peshawar called what is it, Della?
Do they have a place where you can go shoot these guns?
Yeah, you can. They make replicas of all the famous guns. Like, you can go there and buy an Uzi or try one out or a Kalashnikov or whatever. But I didn't get to go. It was near this major holiday, Ashura, which is a Shiite holiday. Again, just like that, the world's most dangerous bridge, another instance where, you know, maybe if I had tried on another day, it might have worked out for me. And then another interesting thing happened. I went to finish up Pakistan in Lahore. For the actual celebration of Ashura, a few other tourists, they stay in the hotel rather than go out on the street and watch the parades, because I guess they thought it was too dangerous for us. So we had police making sure we didn't leave the hotel.
Really?
And then lastly, in Lahore was where they have the famous border crossing into India, where they have a ceremony.
Oh, that's right. You were talking about this before the show.
Yes, that the Pakistani border guards and the Indian border guards put on this routine where they insult each other and basically thumb their nose at each other.
And this is a picture of one of those rangers that you took not quite a selfie, but...
Yeah, that was really interesting. If you can, go on YouTube and watch some videos of this.
Well, I think we have a video that you took, right?
Yeah, if you want to show my video there. Quickly.
This is the not really a changing of the guard, but like the...
So yeah, that was really interesting. Great. And then flew from Lahore, and I took that super long flight from Saudi Arabia to LA. It was like 16 hours. So, anyways,
wow, that's quite a bit.
Yeah.
So Andy, we got some questions in the comment section here. We'll do a little Q&A from the live audience.
Yes, sir. We got a couple questions from the chat. First of all, I want to say welcome to everyone in the chat. Thanks for tuning in, and thanks for everyone who has submitted a question tonight. We really appreciate it, as always. All right, so jumping right in here. First question is from Carlos Mogahan, and they want to know, did you have any instances of bad treatment from people as you were walking through the city in Iraq, and how were you treated from customs when you got in?
Northern Iraq.
Northern Iraq.
Northern Iraq, excuse me.
I had zero bad experiences with anybody. I think as far as what you were describing, maltreated. The hotel I stayed in where the air conditioner was going out, I argued with the guy who ran the hotel for a bit, along with the other guests.
So everybody came out of their rooms when the air conditioner stopped working and be like, hey.
Yeah, when it's like 113 during the day. But no, and that's kind of my point. Everyone was super friendly in these places. Welcoming, getting through the border when I landed in Erbil was easy. I got my stamp in no time. People welcomed me. No issues, no threats, no dirty looks, nothing. Quite the opposite. I felt a warm welcome everywhere I went.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. What else we got?
Next question is, was there ever a moment when you were driving that you just felt, I may not make it out of this?
You did say you pulled over and you just wanted to cry.
Yeah, that was in Abbottabad. Coming in, I mean, just sitting there in traffic on a hill trying to deal with a stick shift and everyone being aggressive, and I had to continue to be aggressive. I wasn't getting anywhere. That was tough, but then of course some of the passing was really hair-raising on that highway. Get around the truck, and people pull it close there. The local drivers, you know, it may be a car coming the other way, and you have to pull off to the shoulder of the road to avoid them. And even I, maybe on a couple occasions, was a little risky. I know my mom's watching, so she's not gonna like this, but a little risky in passing, and it was a bit hair-raising. So,
I bet.
Next question comes from Scott Crawford, who wants to know, where are these blogs you talked about?
So there was a one, I think I remember a guy, Against the Compass, if I've gotten it wrong, who talked about the hiking in Pakistan, or was it Iraq? That was one guy. I can't really remember. My friend who went, whom I got the idea of Northern Iraq from, her blog is called Bunch of Backpackers. But if you just Google hiking in Iraq or hiking in Pakistan, a bunch are going to come up. That's how I found them.
Gotcha. All right, last question.
Last question comes from Carlos Modgahan again, and he wants to know, what about the food? What place had the best tasting food?
It was a lot of kebab in both places.
Can't go wrong with kebab.
Yeah. Pakistani food was pretty good. And you can go to the bazaars. I remember Lahore had some good food in the old bazaar. But I'll tell you, I love eating the local stuff. And you just go into these restaurants where people are eating on the ground. You sit on a piece of wood, and they hang you a plate, and they put in very hot rice and lentils and maybe some meat as well and some spicy leafy vegetables. And it costs maybe $1.50 for lunch or dinner. And yeah, this in the Los Angeles rating system of ABCDEF, maybe this would be a Z. But I didn't get sick there. I got sick eating in a hotel on the trip. But those I love eating at those local places, you know, at a bus station or in a bazaar. It's just with the locals.
You know, I've eaten some places like that. And, you know, I haven't eaten food in India like that, which I hear is a no-go. But I've never gotten sick, so...
Yeah.
You know, knock on wood there.
Yeah, I think I've never gotten sick from those kind of street foods. The only times I've gotten sick is in tourist hotels, and that's what happened to me in Pakistan. When I ate at a tourist hotel one night, I got sick.
Yeah. So, Mark, you're also a travel author, right? I don't know if it's travel author, but you're an author. This is your third book. It just came out, He Who Fights with Monsters. This is a great book. I just finished reading it, actually. You get a good shot of that, Andy. I think these books are great. I haven't read your first two, but this is a great book for adventurers.
Thank you.
I think. I encourage everybody to go out there and get a copy. It's on Amazon.
Mm-hmm.
I know the Kindle version's like $5, so can't go wrong there.
It's now $2.99.
So. $3. So if you're an adventurer, which, you know, if you're watching this show, you're probably an adventurer. I think this is a great book. Is there anything you want to say about it?
Yeah, it's fiction, it's a thriller, it's about a guy who starts an organization to assassinate corrupt world leaders. So it's a guy who figures out that basically sending money and food to these countries doesn't do any good unless you've got a government in place that is going to make sure it's properly distributed and the people have opportunities and their rights are protected. So he starts an organization of mercenaries to go out and assassinate.
So he kind of goes Batman on it, huh?
Yeah. Assassinate corrupt world leaders.
You know, you did a 9-month tour through Africa, right? You did a solo trek. Did you run into a lot of corruption there? Is this kind of talking from experience? Anybody who's traveling and has to bribe someone or otherwise gets screwed over by some corrupt official gets pissed off about it, right?
Yeah, it happened from time to time, not as much as you might think when I was traveling by myself. The first part of this book takes place in West Africa and Mali, which were places I had visited, Timbuktu and Djenne and places like that, Niger River. So that trip informed of a lot of where I set this book, and also Zimbabwe as well. One of the climatic scenes of an assassinate takes place in Harare. Yeah.
So I'll tell you, it's very satisfying if you have I've been described as having a hyper-developed sense for justice, which means like, you know, I see injustice and it just really rubs me the wrong way. So I feel like this book is pretty satisfying from that perspective. That's all I'll say about it.
That's one of the things I was going for.
Yeah. So it's a fun, good read. So again, you know, help support these people we have on the show, like Mark. He's got a book. Go buy it. Go read it. You won't be disappointed. Well, Mark, thanks for coming out. Is there anything else you want to say? Anything else you want to plug? Your other two books, I didn't mention those.
No, I think I'll just keep it safe and plug this one.
Okay.
But thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure. And again, really happy that the club is keeping this going and all the effort that you and Andy are putting into this and the others involved. I mean, this has been excellent. So keep going. And I'm so happy I was able to help and that I feel honored that you invited me to come on.
Thank you. We appreciate having you out here. So, next week from the Adventurers Club, 7:45, we've got Jim Dorsey coming out here to talk about his expeditions around the world. It's going to be great. So if you like this episode, if you like this stuff, you know, subscribe to our channel. That helps us out. Click the bell if you want to be notified of new content. And we will see you next week. Thank you very much.
Jim Dorsey's excellent.
Yes, he is.